Today's show contains some bonus content. If you'd like to check that out, head on over to patreon.com/workingclassaudio.
Working Class Audio is brought to you by GearSluts.com, AEA Microphones, The License Lab, Audio Technica, and Jay-Z Microphones.
This is the Working Class Audio Podcast, session 229.
Working Class Audio, navigating the world of recording with a working class perspective. Here is your host, Matt Boudreau.
Aw, thanks, Chuck. Chuck Smith, everybody. The magical voice, if there ever was one. Yeah, we'll have Chuck on at some point. Anyways, thanks, Chuck. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Working Class Audio Podcast. This is session 229 you are listening to now. My guest today is Ed Brooks. Ed, of course, is the co-owner of Resonant Mastering in Seattle, Washington. We had Ed's studio partner on, Rachel Field, a few weeks ago. She was episode 226. So if you want to get the full Resonant Mastering picture, listen to Rachel, 226, and of course, listen to Ed today, 229. Yeah. So Ed has a long history in the world of mastering. He's been in it for close to 20 years now. He started his career producing and engineering records in basement studios and working his way up into major studios during Seattle's music explosion of the early 90s. And he started full-time as a mastering engineer about 18 years ago. And he's mastered projects for people like REM, Pearl Jam, the Fleet Foxes, Death Cab for Cutie, The Head and the Heart, Chris Robinson, a lot of different people. He also plays pedal steel guitar in several bands based in the Seattle area. So happy to bring you that interview. Ed Brooks coming up here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Grab your coffee cups. Let's talk about the Working Class Audio Journal. You might recall sometime around January, I was talking about the imminent release of the Working Class Audio Journal book. This is going to be volume one. And things got delayed, unfortunately. But fortunately, that time has passed and the book is now out. Ultimately, what happened was is our original publisher, Hal Leonard, sold to Roman and Littlefield. And, you know, they went through a bit of a transition there. That's a lot of moving parts there, a lot of people involved and a lot of data and a lot of books. So the smoke is cleared. The book is out. The good news is you can get it through an Amazon link, which I will provide. The bad news is it's already sold out on Amazon and they're waiting for more copies. So you could still get it at your local bookstore if you order it. Target actually sells it. I would encourage you to go to your local bookstore and give your business to a local business. But either way, the book is available and it features interviews with Andrew Sheps, Kim Rosen, Langston Massengale, and Mark Kilborn. Kind of a wide variety of folks. And there's some extra information in there from me. So hope you enjoy that. It's been a long time coming, and we're already working on volume two, so be sure and check that out, the Working Class Audio Journal. So check that out. The link will be in the show notes. Also want to remind you, there is the opportunity to contribute to the podcast. That happens through Patreon. So if you go to patreon.com/workingclassaudio, you can get access to different levels. Each one of those gets you different things. At the $3 level, you can get an ad-free version of the show delivered to you through the Patreon system. And you can even go up higher and get an autographed copy of the Working Class Audio Journal, which I just mentioned. And you can get plenty of bonus content as well. That's usually gear discussions that we don't typically do in the show, but we do on Patreon. All kinds of stuff. So check it out. Go to patreon.com/workingclassaudio. The link will be in the show notes as well. Yeah, if you're a diehard fan, this is for you. I have to share this deal with you that we've worked out with Jay-Z Mics. They are offering Working Class Audio listeners 50% off of their Black Hole Series microphones. There are two versions of that mic, a three polar pattern version and a cardioid only version. The three polar pattern version is $2,000, so you can get it for $1,000. The cardioid only version is $1,000, so you can get it for $500. It's a one-time offer for each person. All you have to do is go to jzmike.com, use the code WCA, and that will get you 50% off of either one of these mics. So head on over there, take advantage of this deal, and you'll get yourself a fantastic sounding mic. Our friends over at Gear Sluts have a fantastic subforum called Audio Life that we sponsor, where you can actually talk about something other than gear, believe it or not. There's topics that cover life hacks, work-life balance, health and hearing loss, traveling, hobbies. It's a great place to go if you just need a break from the general gear discussion that is going on. So check that out. That's at gearsluts.com, Audio Life. All right, that's it. Let's get to it. Ed Brooks. Here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Matt. Pleasure to be here.
For the listeners, if you get a chance to go back and take a listen, Ed's partner in the business of Resonant Mastering is on episode 226. We're talking, of course, about Rachel Field. So if you want to go back and kind of get her perspective, you can do that. But in the meantime, here we are with Ed Brooks. So, Ed, where did audio become a relevant thing in your life on a professional level? You know, aside from early four-track experiments and stuff like that, when did it become apparent to you that audio was going to play a major role in your life?
It actually happened kind of by chance. I was flunking out of college, and the woman I was dating at the time said, "Hey, why don't we go apply for a job at Tapco?" And I'm like, "What's Tapco?" She's like, "Well, they make PA gear." And went and applied, and I got hired to work in the storeroom to carry stuff. And immediately I just thought it was the coolest thing on the planet because there was music playing all the time. Musicians worked there, and they were willing to pay for me to go to school to learn electronics. So I started learning electronics, started learning how to fix the gear, pretty much immediately became a line tech there and started learning how to run the gear. And at the same time, simultaneously, friends and bands started going, "Hey, you want to mix our sound?"
Now, I have to give a little context here. Tapco, for those that don't know, is the predecessor to Mackie. That's correct, right?
Yeah. When I was working there, Greg had already sold the company. They were owned by Electrovoice, and he was basically waiting till he could start another company.
But Greg Mackie created Tapco, right?
Yep. All the stuff that we were working on were totally all his designs at the time.
It's interesting that they were willing to pay for you to go to school. Was that a common thing at the time for companies?
I don't know. I think that they knew that they could hire from within if their employees knew how to do electronic work. Mm. I guess. I mean, it was just sort of a perk. I mean, we got health insurance and, you know, all kinds of crazy things. It was the 80s. It was a lot different.
So where did that take you?
It took me to deciding that I wanted to like work in studios. And one day I'm there working and somebody comes by and says that they have the phone number for a studio tech who is looking for an apprentice. And like, I jumped out of my seat, you know, "What's his number?" It took a couple of days to get the number out of that person because they wanted the job too. And I called him and in half an hour talked him into hiring me and took a giant cut in pay, lost all my benefits. But suddenly I was basically working in all the studios in Seattle and getting to meet everybody and just learn a ton.
So really coming at it from the technical side of it, of understanding how the gear is built.
Yeah, that was my in. I mean, and Matt, who had hired me, had kind of said to me, "So I really want to make sure you want to be a tech and you're not like wanting to be an engineer." And I'm like, "Oh no, I want to be a tech. I want to be a tech." And he caught on pretty quickly that no, I wanted to be an engineer.
What was it about engineering that drew you away from being a tech?
Oh, I just love music. And I had already, you know, I'd been doing the usual four track, bouncing between four tracks, and I just was in love with it. Single-mindedly, it was all I could imagine wanting to do.
How much of that early start of understanding the tech side of it, have you carried a lot of that knowledge with you throughout the years and added to it? Or is it like a language that's like, well, when I was in junior high, I could speak Spanish, but you know, I don't speak Spanish anymore.
No, I've carried it with me. I mean, there's been several times in my career where engineering work may have slowed down and I could almost always fall back on the tech work. And I also, through working with Matt, learned how to design and wire and install studios. So that was another, you know, skill that I had so that I could always kind of rely on a variety of things basically to continue to make a living.
That's interesting. So it actually created a separate income stream to rely on later on.
Yep. And sometimes absolutely simultaneously. I mean, I could be doing a record for 2 weeks, have 4 days off and be fixing stuff and then back in to do another record and then get hired to build a studio and have that going on for 3 weeks before I would start on another record.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the transition from tech to engineering and carry that story on?
It went back and forth a lot. I mean, in the late 80s, I got hired basically to be a full-time music engineer at a studio called Steve Lawson Productions. And at that point, it was crazy. I was being paid a salary to be a music engineer. I mean, I felt like I was made.
And wow.
It was a great situation, and it was also a hard situation because it was a fairly expensive studio. A lot of the bands that I was used to working with couldn't afford it. So some of my connection to people that I love to work with went away. And I worked there on salary for maybe a year and a half and finally decided to go in and talk to the owner and go, hey, if I go hourly, can I work in other studios? And he was like, yeah, of course. I don't want to get in the way of anybody's career. So that just opened the door for me. So suddenly I could freelance and work really all over the place. And that facility would later build Studio X, which was a really large SSL room, which at the time that it was built, and it was the biggest, most modern, up-to-date studio in Seattle. And I got to work out of that room as a freelance, but a lot of times been doing assistant work. I did assistant work on a Heart record and an REM record in the early 90s there. And really, for the next 4 or 5 years, engineering work was steady enough and the money was good enough that I didn't do really any technical work. But in the kind of mid-90s to late 90s, sort of the big boom of Seattle slowed down. And at that point, there was, you know, a few weeks off. And it was like, oh, what am I going to do? And a couple of friends were studio managers. I mean, just through connections, I found tech work or install work.
Let's go back to those initial years of engineering. Was there anybody that was a key mentor to you or mentors that you can cite?
Yeah. And one of them actually comes back into the picture of my career later. A man named Rick Fisher was kind of I always joke, he was the first engineer who would let me hang out for free over a weekend to help. And it was exciting and I learned a lot, and he was a really talented, really professional engineer. And so I learned a lot from him. Then another one would come along a little bit later when I started working at Steve Lawson Productions. I met a man named Reed Ruddy, who had been a longtime engineer at Kay Smith, which is the facility that we had moved into. And Reed, I mean, to this day, I think Reed's the best engineer I've ever been around. I used to sit in the back of the room and watch him work and go, oh, he's not doing anything. He barely touches anything. He barely moves. And it's just like, and it sounds crazy great. What's he doing? I've known Reed a long time. He is an owner and manager of Studio X up here in Seattle and is a great engineer. And really, I learned a ton from him.
What are some of the key takeaways that you got from Rick and from Reed?
I think from Rick, long-term was a kind of an organizational sense. He was a very focused, he ran his sessions in a really organized manner, which made them work efficiently. And later on, when I started doing some commercial work for jingles, that was just a huge skill to be able to just efficiently get things happening and record singers, strings, horns, drums, and mix all in like 2 hours. And you just had to be organized to do that. I think Reed is where I learned a lot about capturing tone and how to hear it, how to not mess it up, and know when you might need to mess it up. I mean, I think I learned a lot of simplicity from him. Like, I was a young engineer. I wanted to try everything and run this through that, through this, through that. And he'd go, yeah, I just put a mic by that and, you know, aim it right and good gain and it'll sound pretty good. And I was like, oh, wow.
How simple.
God, he's right. Well, Reed also was really, really good with artists, and that communication and relationship, I learned a lot from him. just in watching him and listening to him and the stories he would tell.
What do you think his skills were that he used in communicating with artists?
He has a good sense of humor. He's very friendly and affable and extremely humble. And just it makes him just a wonderful guy to be around. And when he's an engineer, it's just like hanging out with him, having lunch. Same guy, both places. It was really great.
What were some of the challenges for you in your early days?
The biggest challenge for me is that I wasn't a musician. I had grown up in a family where music was not at all encouraged. And I became a hi-fi geek. And that was how I got in. And I sort of felt like at the time it gave me a unique ear, that I listened more as an audience member. But later on in life, I would learn to play. And now I think back to it. And if I had been a musician, I would have been a lot better engineer. I just would have, you know, understood the sessions, understood what was happening better, probably been a better mixer. I just think in general, that would have made a huge difference. I mean, now that I am and I know the impact it has on how I work.
Take me through those years of Seattle and your role in it, where the bands like Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Mudhoney, what was happening on the front lines for you in the world of recording in Seattle then?
You know, that's funny. I was so into bands like REM and that kind of East Coast folk rock that was the music I was pursuing in Seattle. So I was working in a kind of in a different genre. And really when all that exploded, it was like, oh, these are bands I've gone out and seen. But I wouldn't say that I would say I was surprised. I mean, I think everybody was like surprised by how fast and how intense it was. But I wasn't involved in that scene at all in the run-up. I was way more into doing the kind of stuff I loved. After it broke, it made a huge difference. I mean, in Seattle, the professional bar was raised considerably. New rooms were built. Rooms with old gear suddenly became appreciated. And of course, budgets just grew. And so there became a lot more really kind of high-end professional work here.
Did you notice an increase in major label presence?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was this crazy period of time where at least if you were a band in Seattle, somebody was looking at you. There was lots of development sessions, demo sessions. I did a couple of records that spent couple of months in the studios only to get dropped before they were ever released. I mean, it was, I always come up with the word crazy. It was just a really crazy time. There was so much going on. And sort of, I mean, I always say this too, I kind of didn't realize that it wasn't going to last forever.
It's interesting. It's almost like a town that discovers it's got oil or gold. It's like a boom.
It was.
And all of a sudden, you've got people moving there and living there that, had it not been for that, would probably not even consider it.
Yeah. Absolutely. There were so many musicians who moved here and so many producers that I met in Seattle who never would have been here if it hadn't have happened.
To some degree, it feels like Nashville is like that now. It seems like everybody and their dog wants to move to Nashville, which I love Nashville.
Yeah.
And often talk about it on the show. I think if my kids were school age, I'd probably want to move there. But
yeah.
But did you notice a change in the climate of the people that did live there that you knew? Did you notice any personality changes or did you notice any changes to the typical landscape that otherwise wouldn't have happened?
I think so. I mean, bands became more competitive. Yeah, that's hard to answer. I mean, I think that it completely changed the landscape and now it's even hard to sort of quantify the difference because before all that happened, Seattle was a very small community, 20, 25, you know, original bands that were like out gigging regularly. And I'm sure that number's kind of small. And then before you knew it, there seemed like there were thousands and everybody was vying for something.
Mm. And what was happening in your world? You were working with these bands that you say were more like REM and in a different scene than what was actually going down. So...
And after that, it changed because I was an engineer, did very little production work. And so I started getting hired to do records. And so suddenly I was doing records that were in different genres. And I got hired for a record because I was from Seattle and the band thought that I would be able to get kind of a heavy sound like a Tool record. And totally because I'm from Seattle.
Wow.
And... And of course, the band didn't sound like Tool at all, so.
How naive of them. Well, so continue on the journey there. Tell me more about your progression as an engineer through that time period and beyond.
The best thing that happened to me through that period of time is I got to work with Scott Litt. I got to work with Mick Gazowski. I got to work with Joe Ciccarelli. And I got to work with a producer named Daniel Ray, who I really loved. And a couple of other guys I worked with were Dwayne Barron and John Purdell. And, you know, it was like going to work and going to school. And I just learned so much from being able to listen to what they're doing, being able to help them work. You know, cliche, it changed everything. I mean, I changed everything about how I approached work. It changed the monitors that I loved. It changed the mics that I loved. It just made me approach everything differently. And I, the fact that I got the chance to work either as an assistant or engineer for all of those guys was just huge in my development and also just super fun.
Now, doing that, you know, that obviously is a great thing, but sometimes sessions get tense. And when you're working with somebody who's kind of, you know, a name brand engineer, things can get intense on occasion.
Oh, yeah.
And how did you handle those moments?
Tried to hold myself together as best as I could, you know? I mean, I'm a relatively calm person, but there's just no choice other than to like hang in there, do the right thing, keep a level head, be cool, and come back to work the next day.
Yeah. And I assume that you learned how to, in spite of having others lose their shit around you and the intensity to grow, you seem like a very calm, even keel guy.
Yeah, I think pretty good on the outside. Yeah, sometimes on the inside, it gets a little crazy. And, yeah. You know, I'll have to admit, I mean, there were times where some of those guys really helped me out. On the Heart record that I worked on, Denny Carmazzi was the drummer. And he came in the first day and Studio X had really just been completed and setting him up. And we had headphone mixer stations, which were kind of new in our world. And I handed him a set of headphones. He plugged in, he took the mixer and he just yanked everything up to 10, the amp up to 10. And I think it was like a Crown D75 or something. And he hits his snare a few times. And then he turns to his drum tech and says, "I can't hear myself." I'm like, uh-oh. And so I'm like, oh my God, what am I gonna do? So the first thing I do is I pull an amplifier from the shop, probably a bigger Crown. I throw it on the floor. I wire the thing up and hand him headphones and whack, 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 whack. Again, twist tech. I can't hear anything. So by the end of that day, essentially didn't have a headphone mix going for Denny. The next day, he comes in and he's got his Walkman and he plugs his Sonys into his Walkman and he's jamming to it. And I think his tech goes, "Why don't you try your Sonys?" And he plugs his Sonys into this headphone mixer, whack, whack. And of course, it just blows them out. So now the tech's telling me, "Oh, your system just blew out Denny's headphones." So I'm running out to Reed going, "Oh my God, we just blew out Denny Carmazzi's headphones." And I think at this point that Dwayne Barron, who's one of the producers, could tell I was starting to really lose it. It'd been 2 days and I can't get a headphone mix going. And he's like, "Oh, you know what, man? You should just get a set of those Fostex T20s. They'll get loud enough, I promise." I run out to Reed. "Oh man, we need Fostex T20s, blah, blah, blah." And I don't know how he did it, but we had a set there the next day. So here comes Denny the next day. I hand him a new set of headphones. At this point, he won't even look at me. And he whacks his snare a couple times and doesn't say anything. I'm like, "All right, I'm just going to walk away." And they actually start tracking. And then after they're done tracking, he walks in and he goes, "Hey, Ed, what's going on?" And from then on, he figured out I was into Formula One racing, and he was, and we became total buds.
But it was a little tense there in the early days.
Yeah, and Dwayne Barron just saved my ass, because I would have had no idea that there was a headphone that I hadn't heard that could get really loud and make drummers happy.
Our friends over at AEA Ribbon Mics and Preamps help make the podcast possible. They, of course, are well known for their R44 series of mics, their R88 stereo ribbon, and their new KU5A hypercardioid ribbon mic that they recently introduced. And they are also, of course, known for their very transparent and high-gain preamps. So be sure and check them out at aearibbonmics.com. There'll be a link in the show notes and, of course, a banner on the right-hand side of the Working Class Audio page as usual. So be sure and stop by and check them out. Were you surviving then?
It was, I could pay rent. I couldn't own a house, but I felt like I was doing pretty good. I mean, I was 30 Yeah, I felt like I was doing good. I mean, I was thinking down the road I would become a famous producer and make a lot of money. But at that point, yeah, I felt like I was doing good.
How did mastering enter into your world?
Mastering entered into my world at total low point in my career. I had reached the second half of the 90s in Seattle was definitely harder to get the kind of work that I was used to and survive. And so I had been doing tech work and I did a record for Mark Eitzel, I think in 97 or 98. And in the aftermath of that, I got contacted about doing a record for the Breeders. And I'm like, oh my God, here we go. It's like, this will be great. This will be big. It kind of turned out there was stuff going on in my personal life that just made it impossible for me to leave Seattle for a stretch of time. So I had to turn it down. And I was kind of in that spot of like, oh, I just turned down this record. Man, I don't know if I'm going to be able to continue to do this. By chance, I ran into old friend Rick Fisher and was kind of catching him up on what had happened to me in the last 10 years. And he was catching me up on what he had done. And he said to me, hey, you know, I've got a mastering studio. You should come check it out. I said, okay. And in my head, I'm going, oh man, local mastering's really lame. You got to send it to Wally Troggett in Los Angeles, or there was somebody in Nashville that I used to hire who was cheaper. And it was in his apartment and checked it out. And it was a cool little setup. He was using the HD1s, which are monitors that I had used at times in my career. So I liked those. And it was still the infancy of digital audio. So we were capturing in Sound Designer 2, I think. Hmm. Projects were coming off of analog tape. I think it was a big deal that he had an Apogee 20-bit converter. And honestly, I thought, oh, okay, here's another thing. Like I could be making records, I could be fixing stuff, I could be mastering, this'd be great. So I kind of hung it out to my friends that I was going to start doing mastering. And one of my friends hired me right away. And I did a punk rock record for him that I learned a lot about the fact that it needed to be a lot louder than I thought. That was a good lesson. He brought me a record about a month later and he's like, oh, this band's really cool. They're math rock. I don't know what math rock is. And I put the tape up and I'm just like, oh my God, what is this? It was like the heaviest, craziest music I'd ever heard. And I thought about it. And I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And then I realized, well, who's going to listen to this record? And I'm like, oh, it's going to be like 14-year-old dudes who are just mad. And when I was like that, I was listening to Black Sabbath. And so I'm like, oh, I'm going to make this band sound like Black Sabbath. And the band was called Botch. The record did really well in the hardcore scene. And suddenly I was getting work from outside of Seattle. It just kind of snowballed and eventually would move into doing a more indie rock and that type of stuff, which is probably my main diet now. But it was like third record I mastered and I suddenly had a career and was getting more calls to master. And then once I was doing it regularly, I started turning down engineering work because I would go, oh, if I stop this mastering thing, I'm going to lose this momentum. And I had ridden the roller coaster of being a freelance engineer long enough to know that when you got momentum, you go with it. I just realized yesterday that it was probably April of 99 and we're sitting here at the end of March of 2019. So I'm 20 years down the road.
Was Rick your mentor for mastering?
Definitely to start with. Yeah. To start with, I learned a lot from him, but I also learned really quickly that he and I had probably the most polar extreme tastes of any two engineers that I've encountered. Like we just liked such different things and had such a different aesthetic that in a certain way, we couldn't really help each other very much. Hmm. And so in a funny way, I really didn't have any. I had a conversation one day with Eddie Schreier and he told me some things that to this day I still do and think about. And then the rest of it was listening. I spent a lot of time listening and kind of trying to sort out what guys were doing. But otherwise, it's kind of a self-taught thing here. And honestly, to take one step further, working with Rachel, she and I aesthetically are much closer. And so I think we trade information a lot and I learn a ton from her. And I mean, I can't speak for her, but I hope that the stuff that I offer that helps her.
Yeah. Did your financial world change slightly in terms of stability when it came to mastering?
Yeah. Long term it did because it was really steady. And there was just never the, oh, I got 2 months here. What am I going to do? I mean, it was like having a weekly paycheck. It could almost count on exactly how much money I would make. I mean, at that time, RFI was very structured about how many days a week I had of available studio time and so on. And it was comfortable enough that I took weekends off. A lot of times I took Monday off too.
Just to give a little context to the listener, RFI is the mastering house that we're talking about here, which I believe stands for Rick Fisher Industries.
Yeah, incorporated, but yeah.
Or incorporated, yeah. And this was Rick's company, and you were working essentially for Rick?
As a contractor. So I was still basically a freelance engineer. So I still had the flexibility to do whatever I wanted, but it totally fit the bill. It was totally enough, and it caught on.
I'm curious if, for you, did you feel any sense of identity crisis over making that shift to mastering because of your early desires to be a producer? And we all know it's a different mindset to be a mastering engineer. It's different in general.
Yeah.
And sometimes being in the heat of the moment with the band, I know that, you know, as my tracking goes down and my mixing and mastering continues to rise, sometimes I get a little pang in my heart and I'm like, oh man, I need to get in the studio.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you went through anything like that.
Oh, big time. Big time. I mean, I still to this day miss tracking. I mean, that's the best. It's just like everybody's there, everybody's working together. You know, there's a squeak in the drum kit. We got to figure out what that is. You know, it just all of it. And then you sit back and people play music for you. I mean, it's the best. But I mean, I just somehow realized that mastering just really suited me. My temperament, where my talents lie, it just really suited me. And I was really lucky. I came in at a time when, again, digital audio was really just starting and the opportunity was there. And I had a big community of people around me who already knew who I was. And so I had definitely a built-in client base and just really had a lot going for me to kick it off the ground.
Were there early mistakes that you made in the mastering process?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, it's just normal stuff. Like, I kind of didn't get maybe the tone the band was shooting for. I always kind of had an inkling towards warmer, rounder. And once in a while, you just get a band that really wants it hard, bright. And definitely had a couple that I just didn't get. One, I got fired. But that was actually turned out to be brilliant because then I got to hear Bob Ludwig spin on what I had done. And that was like, oh, another moment of going to school. And then later there was another record where I did it twice and got fired and got to hear another engineer spin on it and learned things again that to this day I do that I didn't do before that day.
How do you handle being fired in those situations?
Oh, I feel like shit. I hate it. But the only thing you can do is just obviously be as gracious as you can be. And I think the fact that the first time that it happened, I learned a lot. And so I just have every time, because it's, you know, it's happened a couple times since the two stories I told you. And both times I was able to figure out and learn from it. I mean, that's all you can do. And those are the lessons that usually will hang around the longest.
Does it change how you qualify a band when you're first starting with them in terms of the questions you might ask?
No. I mean, that you have to still trust totally what you do. Because if you second guess who you are and what makes you make the decisions that you're going to make, then you're just guessing. Every time I've ever done that, it just hasn't gone great.
So you go with your gut now and your experience when you hear a piece of music and...
Yeah. I mean, I always have. I mean, that's the only thing that you got. It's like, what does it sound like to you? You know, that's based on a couple of things. I mean, I've been listening to these monitors for going on 20 years, and I listen to a lot of records on these monitors. So I feel like I have a pretty broad picture of what the rest of the world sounds like and what people are looking for. And you just have to trust your gut. I mean, yeah. I tell myself this all the time, because once in a while, you know, you'll get contacted to do a shootout and you're like, oh, who are they shooting me out with? What should I do? Should I try and sound loud, mid-rangey? Boy, I probably better make it loud enough. And eventually you just got to do what you do, because if they like what you do, then it's going to be fine. If you do something you're not normally you and they hire you, then it might be like a harder thing to do.
Yeah. When I spoke with Rachel, she explained to me how Rick Fisher eventually stepped aside and sold you guys the business. You rebranded as Resonant Mastering and kind of streamlined a little bit of how things were done. From your perspective, what were the challenges in taking over a business, a mastering business like that? And did you have great fears in that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, this is what I do. Rick wants to step aside. This is where I do it. Wow. I'm going to have to find money and buy it. And really, for the run of RFI, I was a engineer who was very taken care of. I really paid very little attention to he would have never involved me in the actual business dealings of the place. But even just in the daily booking, how parts were made, all of that I was insulated from. I was just kind of the happy, you know, engineer who showed up and did his stuff and went home. And so it was jarring to suddenly to see the bank account, to look at every piece of gear in this room and go, oh, Rachel and I own that now. If that breaks, that's our money to fix it and that type of stuff. And I also saw the challenge and really upped my game in trying to get work. When working at RFI, I had a pretty built-in thing and people heard records and they contacted me and I had no social media presence, really anything. And so once we changed, it was like, okay, I need to like have some social media presence. I need to promote myself, you know, I've got to do all this stuff so that this business survives and thrives. So all of that was just a huge change.
Yeah, a little different than the days of just being able to sit down and do your craft and go home and get paid.
Yep, a lot different.
All the unfun things that surround an audio professional's world that fortunately some people are insulated from it and some others are not. So,
yeah, I think that the economics of this industry is going to make studio owners, engineers, and managers all the same person, and they're also going to be the promotional person, and they're also going to be the bookkeeper, and it's just the only way to streamline it enough to make a living.
Yeah. You've been in Seattle now for quite some time.
Yep.
You've seen the metamorphosis. You've seen the change. I'm sure the cost of living has gone up. And it's a different Seattle than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's a different Seattle than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
The last 5 years have been actually really dramatic here.
What are your observations of the music/recording world of Seattle as compared to 5 or 10 years ago?
Unfortunately, we've lost some studios, which has been hard. I feel like the music scene is as vibrant as ever. I mean, there's a lot of great bands playing up here now. There's bands that people are going to hear that they're going to get attention. There's that side of it, I think, is still really strong. There's been a lot of young engineers who have come on in the last 10 years who are doing great work. Obviously, probably like everywhere in the world, there's a lot more stuff being made in home project studios. Obviously, that trend's just going to continue. And I think really the biggest marker for me in the last 10 years is just the closing of some of the rooms in Seattle and that no really big major room has opened.
How's the cost of living shaped up for all of you?
It's crazy. I think it's really hard. I think it's kind of hard to tell. A lot of people are moving to the outskirts of Seattle. I mean, I think that the city is kind of in a crisis because of it. At least certainly the arts community is. I think the city, of course, likes all the big high-tech money.
Oh, yeah. I bet they do. Yeah. I think, as you said, more and more studios are closing. People are having home-based studios more and more and more. And like legit day-to-day working class folks are doing audio out of their homes out of necessity.
Yeah.
Where does the bulk of your work come from?
I bet it's a pretty even balance between the two. Part of it's hard to tell because I would venture to guess that 40 to 50% of my work doesn't come from Seattle. And so a lot of those engineers, I don't really know what their setup is. And in Seattle, I bet it's about 50-50 or a lot of, you know, records will go into a big room. Again, typical story, big room, track drums and bass, then goes home and gets mixed in an apartment. I bet it's a pretty even balance.
You've been at this for a while. You made some mistakes. You've had some fantastic victories, I'm sure. What has your approach to survival and financial stability, how has that been shaped over the years in terms of, I assume you do things far differently than you used to as a young engineer. So how do you approach being an audio professional and staying financially solvent?
Working really hard, remembering every day that whosever record is on my desk is their record and their heart and soul's in it. And you gotta be there. You just gotta treat it like it's yours, even though it isn't. You're just helping it along. I think honoring what you do. And I am extremely fortunate because I'm in the kind of the title of your show. I've really kind of feel like that's where I've been my entire career. I mean, I made enough money to buy a house, be able to pay for a house, but never felt like I was above working class in general. I think that I've been really fortunate to be able to do it as long as I have. And I know that if people didn't like what I do, I wouldn't be able to do it. So obviously there's something about the way I hear music that other people like. And that kind of speaks back to just always trusting myself and what I'm hearing and what I think is the thing to do.
And work-life balance, how does that work for you?
Right now, ever since Resonant Mastering opened, it's not healthy at all.
You're there a lot.
I'm here a lot, and I am willing to work a lot more than I used to be, and I am here, I'm here a lot. And honestly, it's because people are asking me to work, and so that's great, and I'm going to do it. I think in the RFI years, I had plenty of days off. I had plenty of weekends off. I still have the opportunity to play a lot of music, which for me right now is kind of the fun, the camaraderie, and those are my closest friends, all of my bandmates. And I have the time to do it. I can always set aside the time when I need to, so it works. But I'm pretty much involved in music or studios every day, all day.
Not a bad thing to be involved in.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Wow.
Really lucky.
Ed, it's been great meeting you, and I hope to meet you in person in the future. Best of luck to you and Rachel and Resonant Mastering in what you're doing. It seems like you're doing just fine.
Well, thanks, Matt. And yeah, if you're ever in Seattle, please look us up. We'd love to show you the place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you again. And for the listener, there will be a link in the show notes. Check out resonantmastering.com. Ed Brooks here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Thanks for being with me today. Be sure and stop on by workingclassaudio.com. Check out today's show notes and links. And if you get a chance to click on one of our sponsor links that help make the show possible, that's great. I'm talking about Audio Technica, GearSluts.com, AEA Ribbon Mics, The License Lab, and Jay-Z Microphones. I want to thank everybody that helped make the show possible. That includes Mr. Cliff Truesdell on the Working Class Audio theme music, and Marie Plo on the editing, and the lovely voice of Mr. Chuck Smith there in the beginning. So spread the word, tell all your friends, make sure and check out the Working Class Audio Journal, and take care.